Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
All right. Hey there. I am Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, and I am so pleased to be with you tonight. You know, this is the only show right now that you can listen to that has to do with sexual addiction. And I feel honored and excited to be with you. So, how did I get into this, right? Well, I got to tell you, I'm a therapist of 35 years, and about 6 years ago, I decided I wanted to go into coaching. You know, that is taking somebody's life to the next level, which I feel really, really good about. And I really wanted so badly to help people to find their potential, their purpose, and their passion. And so I got certified. That took a couple of years. And then, because I always want to get further education, I said, okay, now I want to do sexual addiction. And some of my friends and some of my colleagues said, now, why would you go from taking people to their highest potential? Why would you go from that high and then want to help people who are obviously at a bottomed out low? Well, here's the reason. One is that I believe that sexual addiction is a brand new field, and I want to help people access services and resources when more than likely they can't find good resources and services otherwise. Okay, so I really want to help them. And then, on top of it, what I know to be true is that working in this field means you absolutely can have no judgment, and I'm a judgment-free therapist. I have to tell you, any CSAT is. You cannot go in this field and have judgment. So I felt like I was kind of qualified. And then, on top of that, I truly, truly, truly wanted to help people to put their lives back together, because what I know is that sexual addiction destroys lives. You know, it is the biggest betrayal to yourself, to your partner, and sometimes to your family. And so that's what I knew to be true, that clearly and most definitely, I wanted to be part of the collateral damage control, if you will. And so I went ahead and got my certification. You hear me talking about it all the time. I got that through ITAP, which is the International Addictions Institute, and Patrick Carnes has put that thing together, and it is an amazing educational opportunity, and I am so grateful to have been trained by the best. Okay, now, here's what I didn't know. You know, I knew the kids were suffering from this disorder. I had actually gotten lots and lots and lots of referrals from administrators at schools prior to me even getting the certification. Somehow I had been deemed the sex therapist of Indianapolis. So people were contacting me going, what do we do? You know, Sally's having oral sex with Tom on the bus. We don't know what to do. They're 10 and 12 years of age. There's all sorts of texting going on. Videos are going around all over the place. This is out of control. We're scared of it, Carol. And so I helped people to gain some normalcy and to help kids to recover. And that's really when I decided, okay, I got to do this. The training, I'm the only Indianapolis therapist who's a CSAP. And my background is, by being Carol the coach, I do television segments and radio. I've had several radio shows, not necessarily on drive time, but on Saturday nights. And I'm not at all adverse to disseminating information to anybody who will hear it via radio and television. And so what I also knew to be true was that when I was doing my Saturday night show, I was getting a lot of people that really wanted help with this situation. And they weren't afraid to call me on a Saturday night, of course anonymously, and talk about their compulsion for sexual addiction, or their compulsion for having many affairs, or their compulsion for outrageous behavior like exhibitionism and voyeurism and frauderism and those kinds of things. And so I thought, well, if people can do that in their own community, if they can share those feelings, those fears, I need to do an internet radio show. And to my knowledge, I tell you this every week, I do believe I am the only internet radio show on sexual addiction per se. And, you know, I'm proud of that, but at the same time, I got to tell you, we need to get more information out there. I encourage other people to have radio shows. I'm begging for more people to become CSATs, you know, and this has taught me so much about compulsion and addiction and obsession. And, you know, what I know is the people I work with, they cannot stop. They cannot stop until they use the right recovery tools. And so my show is geared towards helping you know who are the experts out there, what are the books to read, what are the best treatment centers, what are the best intensives that you can take, what can you do to get healthy. And tonight I'm going to be interviewing founder and clinical director of the Center for Relational Recovery, Michelle Mays, and she's a CSAT with over 13 years experience in providing individuals, couples, and group therapy with those struggling from sexual addiction, love addiction, trauma, and relationship issues. She's out of Leesburg, Virginia, but I highly recommend that you take a look at her website, and we're going to be talking about how you can get a hold of her, because obviously she is the clinical director of relational recovery, and that is so important. She uses the Pia Melody model. And Pia Melody, as you well know, is an amazing expert in the field of love addiction, relationship issues, sex addiction. And Michelle is in the process of completing her certification in emotionally focused therapy for couples. So tonight will be a great night to learn about what you can do if you feel like your relationship has been severely damaged by sexual addiction. And we're going to have her on here in about 5 minutes or so. So I'm really looking forward to that. She has offered to our listserv a lot of good information. you know, I'm oftentimes soliciting from people that are the experts. Hey, will you come on the show? Will you talk about it? Will you teach my listeners about relational recovery or about love addiction or dependency needs or healthy attachments or unhealthy attachments or intimacy disorders? Well, Michelle is an expert in all of the above, so I'm really excited to be interviewing another CSAT who has been trained in post-induction therapy. We're going to find out about that. That's Pia Melody's therapy. And she's a writer, trainer, and speaker on so many issues that have to do with couples, but especially sexual addiction. Okay, now, last week I did a workshop on trauma and attachment disorders. And I've got to tell you, you know, what I know to be true is that oftentimes sex addicts have attachment disorders because of abuse and neglect they experienced in childhood. And then, this may come as no surprise to you, they hook up with partners who also have had sexual abuse in their past, emotional and physical abuse in their past, and all of a sudden it's like they're reliving their childhood. And they're like, oh my goodness, how can this be happening again? Now, I'm here to reframe that, guys. I'm a believer in if you're dealing with it again, it really means that it is the second time that you can actually get this thing right. You know, as an adult, you can figure out what is it that you need to make your life better. I'm a big believer in that. So if you're dealing with something that feels so familiar and you're disheartened and disappointed and discouraged, I want to encourage you to know that it's an opportunity to really get things right. And I so appreciate that, because when you have that opportunity to get things right, you then can make your life better by figuring out, okay, what do I need to do? What boundaries might I need to set? What skills do I need to learn? And for so many people, that is skills like assertiveness. Letting people know what you want, what you feel, and what you believe. It does not mean that you get your, you know, get what you want, but it does mean that you're clear and direct about what you think, how you feel, and what you do believe. And that's important. You want to know that you were clear and direct. I kid you not. That is so important. So, okay, that's one skill that you need to learn, as well as boundaries. You know, I was talking with a woman today, and she said, my husband has not talked to our child about what he has done. And I want him to do that. I believe that will right the wrong, and I believe that it will interrupt the generational cycle of addiction. And I support that. If that's what this couple wants to do, I want to help them. Because when you're working with kids, you don't necessarily want to give them too many details. You just want to give them the facts. And so I went over that, and she said, well, can I tell my son that my husband has had many affairs at work, and that it has almost jeopardized his job, which wasn't true. It hasn't, unfortunately, jeopardized his job, but it could have. And I said, no, you don't want to go that far. You want to say that your husband had affairs, some of which occurred at work, period. You don't want to go into the details. We don't want to scar kids. We want them to feel safe. We want them to still connect with their mom and dad. And we want them to feel that sense of trust. And that means you don't inundate kids like they're your best friend and you're giving them all the gory details. That is a tough situation to know how to handle. And so I really encourage you to read Stephanie Karn's book, On Mending the Shattered Heart or Facing Heartbreak, which teaches you how to absolutely make the right decisions. And I promise you that with good guidelines and a great model, you can do that. But you don't want to just do it willy-nilly, and you don't want to just do it by the seat of your pants, because you will end up doing more damage than you can possibly imagine. You actually want the straight scoop from a CSAT, because we've been trained on how to work with families. You know, most therapists don't even know how to touch this stuff, and then they don't know what to do. So unfortunately, you may get information that is not helpful, and it's not good advice. It wouldn't be the first time. We as therapists don't always know what we're doing. It really requires that we be trained in so many areas. Does that make sense? Okay, so if you're considering talking to your child, I'm going to ask you to do the research. Get with the program, get the proper information, and really go slow. Don't go overboard. Trust in the process, but make sure you know what the process is. Again, it can be very, 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 very difficult. So what I promise you is that the most important thing is to have good guidelines and not fly by the seat of your pants. Because if you do, you'll do irreparable damage. And you don't really want to do that. I know you don't. Okay. Now, it can be very, very tough to know how to handle situations. And that's why I say, talk to a certified sexual addictions counselor to know what you need to do. And don't let your emotions and your feelings take over. Because I promise you, if you do, you'll regret it. And the last thing I want you to do is to regret it. Why? Because clearly, you know, that's not what you want. You want to be able to handle situations in such a way that you have pride in handling tough, difficult information. Okay. So, I am going to encourage everybody to do what I call bibliotherapy. And that means that you get the right books and study what you need to do, especially if you don't have a CSAT in your area. You know? Absolutely. So when we come back, we're hopefully going to be talking to Michelle Mays. I mean, she really has a lot of good information. And you're listening to Carol Jurgensen Sheets. If you need to email me, you can do that at carolthecoach@aol.com. Or you can look at my website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people. Every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why
do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And what does that mean when somebody is reenacting the trauma? What does that mean? It means that something that has occurred in their childhood is playing itself back in adulthood, and sometimes that looks like sexual addiction. So we're going to be finding out more about that, as well as Michelle Mays is going to be talking about how things like that can affect relationships. So, Michelle Mays, welcome to the Carol the Coach Show. How are you?
Hi, Carol. Thanks so much. I'm doing well. And yourself?
Excellent. Well, you know, you have such expertise in working with relationships, and obviously you have trained with the best. So I'm going to ask you a little bit. I want to pick your brain. You know, so many therapists, as well as programs and bibliotherapy, has referred to addiction as an intimacy disorder. And what do you think? Do you believe that addiction is an intimacy disorder?
I do. I see addiction as sort of a three-pronged issue. I see it as a brain disease, an intimacy disorder, and an emotional regulation issue. And so I see all those three things creating addiction, and then they overlap and they impact one another. So there's an author named Craig Macon, who I really like. He does a lot of writing on addiction and recovery. And he has a great quote. He says, addiction is an emotional relationship with an object or event through which addicts try to meet their needs for intimacy. And what he's basically saying is that whatever process or substance you're using compulsively, whether it's drugs or alcohol or sex or food, you are eventually, as you use it over time, you'll begin to substitute that for intimacy and relational connectedness in your life. And so over time, the addiction actually becomes the primary relationship for the person who's using the substance or the sex or the process compulsively.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, and certainly that's why addicts become more and more isolated, and they'd prefer to just be with themselves than the drug of choice, whether that's alcohol, whether that's cocaine, or whether that's sex. So that's why you have become a relational expert, because you actually want to reinstate, maybe even for the first time, a relationship in a healthy way.
Right. I think addiction is unique because it's one of those things that is both the solution to isolation and what creates the isolation. So the more you act out in your addiction, the more isolated you become, the more you're going to act out to handle the loneliness and the feelings that come from that. So it's a problem and a solution all wrapped into one. And the way to really address that and to work with that is to work on looking at how do you actually form healthy relationships with people in your life and begin to use those relationships to regulate your emotional world, to get meaning from life, to have purpose in life, and all of those different things. So that relational piece in recovery, to me, it is the heart of recovery. It's the thing that all of recovery is built around, and it's the most important piece of recovery.
Now, let me ask you, because you said emotion regulation, and for our listening audience, they may not exactly know what that
mm-hmm.
means. So can you kind of break that down and share how an addict may suffer with emotion regulation problems?
Yeah, so if, let's say, I'm just thinking about a lot of my clients right now, and I'm not going to use any one person's story, I'll kind of merge them together, but let's say you grew up in a home that was in some way less than nurturing or perhaps overtly abusive. And in that home, you might have gotten some of your needs met, but you might not have gotten all of them met. Or you might not have had a parent who was able to really pay attention and tend you emotionally, really tend to your emotional needs. And if you grow up in that kind of home and you don't get tended to emotionally, and when you have feelings, which children, if you think about a child, children are one big ball of feelings, and they're very spontaneous and open with their feelings, right? Like they can be crying one minute, and then they can be giggling hysterically the next moment. So their feelings are out there. And if they have parents who do not know how to handle the feelings and affirm the feelings that their child is having, and even just teaching the child how to name the feelings, you know, to be able to say to your child if they've fallen down and hurt themselves and they're crying, oh, that hurts, I'm so sorry, I see you're in pain, I know that it hurts, I'm going to help you take care of that. So if you don't have parents that know how to do that, then, or perhaps you even have parents who actually shame you for your feelings or have a more negative response, there than just the absence of the affirmation, but there's also the, you know, it's not okay to have feelings, or it's not okay to have certain feelings in our household. If you grow up in that kind of house, then as you mature into an adult, you're going to have a harder time knowing what to do with your feelings. Because if you think about it, we all feel things all day long. Our days change. We have events and meetings and frustrating things happen, and the printer won't work, or this person makes us mad. So we're having feelings happen all day long. And if we don't know how to feel our feelings and be okay feeling our feelings and feel like, even though a feeling is moving through us, even though maybe we're mad right now or we're sad right now or we're lonely right now, that we are still fundamentally okay, then what happens is the feeling that's coming through us makes us feel anxious and makes us feel stressed out or overwhelms our system in some way. And so that's what we're talking about when we talk about emotional regulation, is the inability to feel your feelings and still feel that basic sense of I am okay in the world. And instead, feelings become overwhelming or too big to be felt. And that leaves a person really vulnerable then to becoming an addict and using something, whether it's alcohol or drugs or sex, in order to take care of and address their feelings.
Well, that makes sense, as well as what I know to be true is so many of our clients never really felt safe enough or were connected enough, trusted enough to even express their feelings. So they're going to, of course, grow up and have emotion regulation problems.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true for a lot of
people. And then, of course, they're totally set up for having unhappy relationships, because when you can't be your authentic self and share your feelings, you then, of course, really end up finding somebody who is either codependent and wants to help you with those feelings, or you know, they too can't share feelings, and so it's a one big hot mess.
No, that's really true. I think that for a lot of couples that come in, who, particularly couples who are dealing with sexual addiction, at first when they come in, a lot of times the person who's the partner of the sex addict really feels like they're sort of in better emotional shape, like they know how to handle their feelings more. But as time goes on and they start to look at things and look at their own life, they start to realize, I actually have not known how to feel my feelings. I've been caretaking my spouse's or my partner's feelings. Feelings have been a big issue for both of us in the relationship. And it does create a lot of conflict for people and a lot of frustration for people, because they don't know how to do feelings together and do them well.
So you help couples with those kinds of issues, correct?
We do work with couples with those types of issues, yes.
And so help me to understand a little bit, what is it that you do at the Center for Relational Recovery?
So the Center for Relational Recovery is a counseling center that I started about 4 years ago. I've been in private practice for about 15 years, but I just started the center about 4 years ago. And we specialize in working with sex addiction. But we really work with the entire couple, and we're really committed to working with both the partner and the addict and giving each of them equal attention, equal access to treatment, equal support in the treatment process, as well as also the couple. So we kind of see that we have three treatment entities when people come in. We have a partner who we're treating, we have an addict who we're treating, and then we have the couple who we're treating. And so we're really working with all three of those all the way through treatment, and how that looks, it changes throughout the treatment process and kind of who's in the front, like who's getting the most treatment at any given point can change as people go along, or what they need can change. But we're really working with all three parts of the relationship.
Okay, so you started this center about 4 years ago, and what mm-hmm. made you decide that this would be an excellent center to start?
You know, this is the story about starting the center, is that I was actually in what's called the Professional Improvement Program, which was headed by Patrick Carnes, and it was for people who were certified sex addiction therapists to be in. And
I know. I wanted to do that program, too, PIP. It's to help you establish your goals and your dreams. So this was
exactly
part of the programming you were in.
I was. And everybody has, like, a 30-minute phone call with Patrick Carnes as part of that. And I was on the phone with him, and he said to me, he was listening to kind of where I was located and what I was doing, and he said to me, he said, well, don't you want to maybe, like, start a center or do something there? And I said to him, I said, no, I have absolutely not an iota of interest in doing that. No. And he was like, okay, so we moved on to other things. Well, my goal when I was in that program was to be working on a book for partners of sex addicts, which I'm still working on. But basically, in that process of working on that book, and I also had had a waiting list for years and was turning a lot of clients away, and so I thought, I need to train somebody else to do this work. And so I went out, recruited somebody, hired them, and then I thought, well, I kind of need space to put them in. So I got some office space. I thought, I kind of need something to have people refer to, so I need a name. And I did all of that, and then I went out to dinner with one of my colleagues who's also a therapist, and she's older and wiser than me, and we were at dinner, and she said to me, well, once you get your counseling center started, then da-da-da-da-da. And I looked at her and I said, I'm not starting a counseling center. What are you talking about? And she looked at me and she said, honey, you already did. And so it was one of those things that I think, I always say my higher power got it done in spite of me, because I really had no intention. And I almost went behind my own back and did it, which is highly unusual for me. I'm a planet, envision it, execute it kind of person. So it's been quite a journey since then to actually look around and say, okay, I have this counseling center, now what are we going to do? And what is our goal going to be? And what is our passion going to be? And what is our vision going to be? And what are we going to do here? And how are we going to affect our community? And I've had to kind of grow into that and shape it as we've gone along because of how it got started.
Well, that is hilarious as well. Are you sure Patrick Carnes didn't hypnotize you on some level and just kind of pop that suggestion right into the brain? Because it sounds like that's what he wanted for you, too. And even though you said no, 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 you started working on it immediately.
Yeah, it was a really, really funny thing. And I think I had written off doing it without really thinking about it too much. It just wasn't. It wasn't what I thought I wanted to be doing, you know. So,
but
yeah,
I'm sure it felt too big, and then all of a sudden you were chunking it down and making it happen without you even consciously being aware of that, and obviously your friend saw it.
Mm-hmm.
So how many people work there?
So we have a clinical team of five, and then we have a full-time office manager and intake coordinator. And we have anywhere between probably 80 and 100 clients coming through each week, either for group or individual therapy.
That is fantastic, because obviously
mm-hmm.
I had been so impressed with hearing you speak on the listserv and educate people. And so I said, I really do want to interview her. This is a woman who knows your stuff. So can I ask you, obviously, you know, sex or alcohol can become the primary relationship for the addicted person. And so what is your first course of treatment for somebody who has a sex addiction and their primary relationship is with sex as opposed to a spouse or a partner?
You know, our primary course of treatment for that is to put them in group therapy. So we really, you know, at the center, the name of the center is the Center for Relational Recovery, and our tagline is because change happens in relationship. And that is really our core belief that guides everything that we do in terms of treatment, is that we change in relationship with other people, and relationship is where we grow, it's where we get meaning, it's where we get passion, it's where we're enlivened in life. And so our treatment program is group-based because of that. We do individual treatment, individual therapy, and couples therapy as well. But we ask that everybody be in group, and that group is sort of the heart of the program. And so very soon after they come in, after clients come in, we put them in group. And the very first group that we put them in is we put them in a group as a couple. And it's called Foundations for Recovery. And they do 12 weeks. It's a three-hour group. But they sit together, and for the first hour and a half of each evening, the couple is in a room together with other couples or individuals. It doesn't have to be the couple, but most of the time we have a good number of couples in there, and we prefer that couples do it together. But we put everybody in a room, and for the first hour and a half, they get educated. And so I have all my PowerPoints and all the stuff, and I'm up there speaking and interacting with them and discussing with them all kinds of information about sex addiction, about the experience of being the partner and partner trauma with the partner of a sex addict, about what healthy sexuality is, about what it looks like for a couple to be in recovery and to do repair and healing together, the family system. We cover a ton of ground in that group. But I think the thing that has been really powerful for people every time they've gone through the group and all the evaluations and feedback we get is that they've never sat in a room together before and gotten the same information with one another. And there's something about that that is really uncomfortable for everybody and at the same time really empowering and really good for everybody. And so we ask everyone to do that group. So they do that first hour and a half of education, and then the second half of the evening, the second hour and a half, they split up, and the partners go into a group, and the addicts go into a group, and they work on their specific issues that are impacting them, either as the addict or the partner. But the whole evening is a relational experience, and it's built to be a relational experience. And so the first thing we're doing with people is putting them in relationships with other people and beginning that process of teaching them how to connect and how to attach with other folks.
Well, and I love that. I, too, am a real proponent of groups, and whether it be 12-step groups or psychoeducational groups or therapy groups, it certainly has its advantages, whether it be person does not feel alone or the advantage of you learn something when you listen to somebody work with someone else. What we know is when one person does his or her work, everybody does their work. So it's very cost-effective.
It's very cost-effective, and you cannot give a person in individual therapy what they can get in group. They're just very different dynamics, and the power of the group in terms of just learning how to ask for help from the group, you know, like let's say you grew up in a family where you never – you know, got help or you were shamed if you asked for help, to come in and ask the group for help and then have the whole group care about you and try to help you and respond with empathy and with understanding to you, that's a very healing, powerful experience. for people, and you can't do that in individual. You can care for them and stuff, but it isn't the same as a group of people doing it. And so I think group has so many different benefits and advantages, and I think it gives people a place to practice their new relational skills. So it's a place for them to practice asking for help or practice saying, this is what I need or this is what I think, like using their voice to have an opinion, or, you know, not caretaking the other people in the group, learning how to let them struggle, you know, or learning how to let there be strong feelings in the room and not make a joke instead of sitting in the feeling. So there's all kinds of things that go on in group and that are all part of being able to be in relationships well, that you're learning, and you're learning them through an experiential format. So rather than being told, you know, this is how it is to feel a feeling or feel a strong feeling, you're experiencing it, and you're having the experience of learning how to do that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I always say, I don't want to get a call at 3 a.m. in the morning. I want people to be connected enough that they can call each other. And certainly group also offers that opportunity, too.
Absolutely. We encourage everybody in our group to exchange phone numbers with one another and to call one another. And I always tell my clients that in recovery, when you're being asked to do something, it will seem like, okay, you know, they're suggesting that I call somebody in my group. Okay, I can do that. But that the suggestion, whatever the suggestion is, it's usually functioning on a ton of different levels for you. And it's usually going to do way more for you than you think it's going to do. So the simple act of being, you know, told, why don't you call somebody, is so beneficial on so many levels. Like, you get the experience of, okay, I'm upset and desperate enough that I'm going to actually pick up the phone and call. I'm going to do what was suggested to me, even though I don't want to, because I'm desperate enough to do that. And when you do it and you get a person on the other end and you talk to them and you tell them about your desperate situation and everything you're feeling, what you find out is that talking to them helps you start to feel better. So you start to learn, oh, contact and connection with other people makes me feel better and helps me regulate my emotional self. We're back to the emotional regulation issue, right? Or you get on the phone and you ask somebody to help you and you get the experience of them caring enough to help you. And you start to be able to identify your needs and your wants in ways that maybe you hadn't before. So that one simple little suggestion is actually working on so many different levels to teach you so many different things. And I think that's how recovery is. You know, each task and each thing has many layers to it.
So now let me ask you, you know, people come in with all sorts of needs and unmet needs. And I know one of the things that you reference is when people sexualize their dependency needs. So can you explain what that is? And how you treat that?
Yeah, so if you think about sex is a mood-altering thing, right? So it alters your feeling state, basically. So if you're bored, being a prostitute will take you out of your boredom for a while. If you're stressed, doing porn and masturbating may calm you down for a bit. If you're lonely, going out and hooking up with somebody may take away your loneliness for a little while. So for someone who's not addicted, they may have very different solutions to those issues of being bored, stressed, and lonely, but they may have a whole bunch of other things they reach for, like, I'm bored, so I'm going to go do something fun, or, you know, do something that I have as a hobby, or do something as a new challenge, or they may handle stress by problem solving or reaching out to somebody, that kind of thing. So for sex addicts, over time, all of these dependency needs, so all these things I'm talking about are really called dependency needs, meaning they're the needs that we get met through being in a relationship with someone, with other people. So instead of addressing them through relationship with others, they're addressing all these dependency needs through their sexual acting out. And so the answer to almost any feeling state or a need or desire is met through sex. And eventually, those needs and desires and feelings almost become unconscious. It's almost like the stone doesn't even break the top of the water. There's this little ripple underneath. You know, it's barely felt, and it's already medicated with the sex addiction. So I always give my clients the example of TV channels that for non-addicted individuals, they have a lot of channels available to them. So like a whole smorgasbord of channels that they choose from to help them deal with the emotions and the needs and wants that they have. For sex addicts, they've sort of narrowed everything down to one channel. And that channel is what they use for everything. So that's what we mean when we talk about sexualizing dependency needs. It's that all those relational needs have gotten channeled into being met through the sex. And the addicted person often becomes very unconscious about the fact that they even have the need or the feeling. They're not even registering anymore or connected to the fact that they're there.
That totally makes sense, and I'm sure that speaks to several of our listeners that says, yeah, I get that. That's where I've been my whole life. And, you know, those mm-hmm. dependency needs obviously occur oftentimes in childhood, and then they mm-hmm. become sexualized. Now, how do you believe that someone's family of origin may impact their ability to be connected to their feelings and their needs and their wants?
Well, so this goes back to what I was saying earlier about depending on the type of family you grow up in, how your family handles your feelings and your needs and wants will shape your own relationship to yourself and how you handle your own feelings, needs, and wants. And what we talk about often at the center is that you parent yourself the way you were parented. And so if in your family, let's say, you know, I was just sitting with somebody recently, and we were talking about that there was no instance that they could remember of running to a parent for help, like feeling sad, feeling upset as a child, crying, and running to the parent for help. They had no recollection of that ever occurring. And what they talked about was crying was absolutely not allowed, like absolutely not allowed. And so what happens then is this person has grown up, and many clients have grown up to become people who then respond and interact with themselves around feelings and needs the same way their parents did. So for this person, when they start to feel sad or when they start to have emotion, they immediately tamp it back down and feel shame that they've been weak enough to actually have those feelings. It wasn't allowed in their family of origin, and they do not allow it with themselves either. And so for a lot of people, they're parenting themselves the way they were parented. They're living out how they were parented. And there's a whole process in recovery of learning how to reparent yourself and learning how to become, in terms of how you treat yourself and interact with yourself, that nurturing parent that you never had. And so that means learning, first of all, how do I even figure out what I'm feeling and that I have feelings, or what I need and that I have needs? And then how do I start to think about those needs and feelings very differently and then respond to myself about them very differently and affirm and validate that, of course, I have this feeling. Of course, I'm frustrated about this, or of course, I'm sad about this. And how do I now help myself with that? Or, of course, I need this. And, yes, I need this. And how do I get my needs met? So that's a big process in recovery. That people work on, but to me it's one of the most important parts of recovery, because it's really changing that relationship with yourself, and how you handle that is what allows you to then change how you interact with other people and be open then to them meeting your needs, talking to you about feelings, meeting their needs, understanding their feelings in very, very different ways.
Okay, well, that totally makes sense. Now, how does recovery address addiction from an attachment disorder perspective?
Well, so I think everything about recovery is geared toward dealing with this relational issue. You know, if you think about it, and again, this is my bias, like we have such a core belief in relationships, But if you think about it, at any time, on any given day, you are either in relationship with yourself, you're in relationship with somebody else, or you're in relationship with your higher power. And so we are always relational all of the time. And so recovery, everything about recovery is really geared around helping us learn how to be in these relationships with ourselves, with others, with our higher power in ways that are much more functional, much more life-enhancing, much more meaningful and joyful for us. And so everything about the process, from how you do group, how you interact with your therapist, what your therapist is doing with you, your therapist hopefully is operating from a very relational place in terms of really each time you're seeing them, you're in relationship with them and you're in the felt space of that relationship. So everything about it is working on this relational piece with people and helping them be in relationships differently.
Okay, so clearly, you know, it would make sense that recovery means building healthy attachments and healthy relationships, and group is one way to do that, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, it's kind of my process of what happens in the group happens out there. So if you get healthy relationships going in group, you know that's going to transfer over and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you feel group therapy fits into that relational recovery construct?
Well, I think the group fits in kind of like what we said earlier in terms of just being the central place where people learn to practice the new behaviors, and they learn to try them out, and they learn to ask for feedback. And, you know, I think often, I remember one of my supervisors saying this at one point, that the difference between somebody who is in recovery and somebody who is not in recovery is that the person in recovery seeks consultation. So the person who's in recovery knows that they cannot be the sole person in charge of themselves anymore, that when they were doing that, it didn't work out well for them. And so instead, they are learning to live their life in relationship with other people and in consultation and community with other people. So somebody who's in recovery, their first thought when there's a big decision or a big crisis is, I need to get my people to weigh in on this, right? Whoever my people are, my spouse, my friends, my 12-step sponsor, my group, I need to have people give me feedback, help me think about this, be in it with me. And for people who are not in recovery, they may still be thinking, I have a big decision to make and I need to make it on my own. The group really helps people move into this new way of thinking and doing life that is relationship-based and community-based. And they have a place where they can start doing that, where they can start coming each week and saying, here's what's happening for me. I need help with it. Help me group. And the group helps them with it and helps them think about it, gives them feedback about it, gives them insight into it, is just in the space with them emotionally, supports them, all of those things. So they're learning to do that. And group is the first place that they start to learn to do that. And quite honestly, for a lot of our addicted clients in particularly, it's a better place for them to learn to do it initially than in their relationship, in their primary relationship with their partner or their spouse, because often they just really don't know how to do it. It's a new behavior. It's a brand new thing to think about that way and to try. And so because of that, you know, anytime you're learning to do something new, you have to do it poorly before you do it well. And so they're in that process, and sometimes it's a lot more helpful for them to do it poorly and go through the learning curve with group and then take the skill once they have it and then take it into their primary relationship and use it there. And it just saves the partner some of the pain of going through the learning curve with them.
That makes total sense to me. Now, what other suggestions might you have for helping clients to work on their attachment building?
You know, one of my favorite exercises that I give to people, and, you know, so many of my clients do this exercise. I give it out all the time because I really love it, and I think it works really well for people, especially newly in recovery. I basically say to them, okay, so for the next 2 weeks, your job, your task, should you choose to accept it, is to make your phone beep at you 5 times a day. It's usually their phone. Sometimes they have a watch. But to basically make it somehow hit a reminder, send a reminder to you 5 times a day. And each time that reminder goes off, your job is to stop and to take a couple minutes and to come out of your head and down into your body. And I teach them kind of how to do that, how to come in and feel their chest and feel their stomach and feel their arms. That feelings are held in the body and felt in the body, not in the mind. So their job is to come down into their body and see what they might be feeling. And we give them a feeling chart, a chart of feelings that has all these feelings named and written out on it. So they can carry that around in their pocket and pull it out when they have these, you know, the phone beeps at them. They can pull the chart out and look and see, okay, this is what I'm feeling. This is what's happening for me. So they start to build that connection from the mind to the body. Let me just stop and even notice that I need to figure out what I'm feeling. And then let me build the connection to where I actually can feel the feeling, like the feeling is actually being felt in my body and I'm connected to it now. And then let me further learn to name the feeling and figure out what it is. And so I love that exercise. And then after they do that for a couple weeks, we change it and we say, okay, let's have the phone keep beeping at you and keep reminding you. But now when it beeps at you, your job is to stop and ask yourself, what do I need? And so I'm sorry, my electricity just went out. I'm having a thunderstorm here.
I heard a puppy in the background.
Yeah, it's the thunder and lightning. Sorry. They may, as the phone beeps at them, they will stop and figure out, okay, I need a glass of water. I need to use the restroom. I need to get up from my computer and walk around for a minute. I need to go have human contact. I need a hug. I need to talk to somebody. They start to find out that they have a world of needs happening all day long that they didn't even know about before. And then their job is to, once they figure out what these needs are, to start them to meet the needs for themselves and do start that reparenting process. So it's amazing to me how many of my clients will even tell me that just starting to pay attention to the fact that they needed to go to the bathroom, like they were sitting at their computers all day, disconnected from their bodies and not even attuned with, I need water or I need to use the bathroom, and starting to pay attention to that and allow themselves to go get the water, go use the bathroom, go do whatever you need, is actually, even though it sounds very simple, it's actually a pretty profound experience of reparenting that they're getting there. So that's one of my favorite exercises that I have people do, and I have them do it on and off throughout therapy as they're really learning how to build their connection to themselves.
That makes total sense. You know, I cannot... how excited I am that there is this center available. And remind everybody, where is the Center for Relational Recovery? Is it Leesburg, Virginia?
Yeah, we're in Leesburg, Virginia. So we're outside of D.C. We're in the northern Virginia suburbs of D.C., basically the northern D.C. metro area. It's considered part of that. So we're west of D.C., about 40 minutes in Leesburg.
Okay, and if people want to get a hold of you, they can contact you at area code 703-944-8086. Is that correct?
Yep, absolutely. And they can also, on our website, there's a contact us, you know, little email thing where they can send an email. There's a phone number
sure.
for our main intake coordinator. All of that is on the website.
All right, and I want to again remind you that that website is www.relationalrecovery.com. And it's an excellent, excellent website. Now, let me ask you, when are you going to finish that book?
You know, Oh, I need to finish that book. It needs to get done because I just need it off my list. You know, hopefully I really go ahead.
I was going to say, will you promise us when you get the book written that you'll contact us at the show so we can interview you about the book and let people know how they can improve their relationships?
Oh, yes. I would love to do that. That'd be very fun. Yeah. I will definitely do that.
Oh, good. Excellent. And now I'm just going to ask you, because I'm a big believer in dates, will we possibly hear about it next year?
The book?
Yeah.
Yes, I am really hoping so. My goal was to get the draft done this year and get it out to a publisher, because I really have a good probably 60% of it written, and I'm really at the point where I need to go find a publisher and do the next steps on it. So it's not that it's not coming along. It is. It's just slow in between everything else that I'm doing. So my goal is to have it written by the end of the year and begin the process of getting it published and all of that.
Well, perfect. Michelle, please do contact us when you get it done, because we'd like to hear more about that. And I know that's coming our way too. So thank you again so much. People, if you want to find out more about Michelle and the Relational Recovery Center, you can again contact her at www.relationalrecovery.com. So, Michelle, have a great week, and thanks again for the interview.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Talk to you later.
Yep. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. All right, so that was Michelle Mays, and she did an excellent job of describing how that can affect couples. And you could hear a lot of hope, strength, and recovery in her voice as she's talking about how important group work is. And I can't emphasize that enough, too. So another great show. I look forward to seeing you next. Well, you know what? We are going to be doing a replay next week, because guess what? You got it. It is Memorial Day. However, my promise to you is that when we come back in June, we're going to be interviewing John Erigent, who has a lot of information about attachment disorders, which is a common issue for people that have sexual addiction and partners of sex addicts. So listen, I want you to have a great couple of weeks, have a wonderful Memorial Day, and remember, there will only be one of you at all times, so I fearlessly want the courage to be your authentic self. And if you listen to Michelle tonight, you know that means really checking in with your feelings, your wants, and your needs, and find healthy ways to get those met. Hey, we'll talk to you in a couple weeks. Thanks for listening to Sex Help with Carol, the Coach.